Welcome to the Wicked Podcast, where we read the business books you don't have the time for. I'm Marcus Kish.
And I'm Troy Norcross.
And we are your co-hosts for the Wicked Podcast.
So, dude, are we going to break it down today? Let's get down to it. Who's on the show today?
We have Sam Sanders all the way from Washington on our show. And he's talking about the next big idea, which is all a book about new ideas, startups, and these kind of things. And they're awesome. And yeah, we were pretty rocking a really good interview there. What were your takeaways?
I like the way the book is kind of almost a formula of how to actually do the assessment of discovery of a good idea and evaluation of a good idea. But I also challenged him. You know what? I know way too many people that don't want to hear that they've got an ugly baby. They don't want to hear that their idea isn't any good. So, you know, we want to embrace people and say, come along for the ride and learn how to pivot. But don't pivot around your product. Pivot around your problem and understand the value. And you've been hearing me talk about value and value exchange a long time. You'll get to hear it again if you listen to the rest of the podcast. But it was a good, fun interview. He's got a lot of energy. He's got some great experiences and shared a lot with us and hopefully for the rest of our listeners. What were your takeaways?
Yeah, love the problem, not the solution. I like the thing, you know, with all these things, talk about reality. And suppose for big organizations and small startups alike, often small startups are looked at like, oh my God, look at these people. They're so innovative and amazing. Like, well, 99% of them are still failing. Why? Well, you know, they have a solution that doesn't have a problem. They're not checking with reality, not checking with customers, which actually is the same fallacies that a lot of big organizations go with because they haven't, you know, often we work with quite a few of them who don't have it in their process and experience to actually really talk to customers. So checking with reality is just a common thing. Just been working on a project right now where, you know, the organization I work for had a really big, bad feedback loop with the news because they're not checking with reality. And so other people were pointing out how reality looks like for them instead of them doing user research, which should be cheap, easy to do. So it's pivotal, it's essential, it's more important than ever. If you want to be competitive or be innovative or do anything and find that 1% of the ideas you're having that actually is going to get you forward, check reality. And I love talking about that with him.
And it's the kind of thing that it should be so important that you die not having that would be a really, really bad thing. But rather than die having not listened to our full podcast, let's go listen to Sam.
Before the interview, a quick word from our very first sponsor, Zencastr. We use Zencastr for all our audio and video recording, and it's a very nifty tool that splits up all the channels for very easy editing. Zencastr is used by 10% of all active podcasts. You can get 40% off the first 3 months and unlimited audio and video recordings with our special coupon code WICKEDPODCAST. I repeat. Wicked Podcast for 40% off. And now the interview. Hello, everyone. Today we're here with Sam Sanders. Hi, Sam. Thanks for joining us all the way from Washington and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And as usual, we start at the top. So please tell our listeners who you are and why you wrote the book.
Yeah, so I'm the author of Your Next Big Idea. And it's all about how successful creatives, innovators, entrepreneurs come up with their big ideas. I decided to write the book a little bit because my background almost led me there. I started working at Inc. 5000, fastest growing company, so a really small company that was having a lot of success. And I was part of the R&D department. So in that area, I really got to see how a small company looks at innovation, how they're looking at growing ideas, how they're moving from there. After that, I worked in business development for a very large company, a Fortune 500 company. And there I got to see like how a very big company is looking at innovation, growing ideas, and like creativity. And lastly, I was an entrepreneur myself. I started a company called Wondershirt. It was athletic clothing for athletes. And at its peak, we sold training clothing to athletes prepping for the 2016 Olympics. And what ended up happening is I was giving a talk at my university, and I sort of realized that all of these different size companies and people look at creativity and ideas in different ways. And it can be challenging because when we talk about these innovative ideas, we always look at like the Apples or the Googles, or like these big companies that are already there, but we don't talk about the garage where that company was formed, like how they came up with the idea in the first place, how'd they get there. And so that gave me the idea to write Your Next Big Idea. And now I work on a company called Herd, so no longer working on Wondershirt anymore. But that's how I got here. And now you've invited me on your podcast, so thank you so much.
And we are really stoked to have you on the show. You use the magic word innovation, and Marcus and I have been around innovation for quite a while. Now, I believe that there are four I's, and that most of the time, people in corporates especially start off with saying they want the first I, which is innovation. But in reality, they want one of the other three I's. They want ideation. They want people in brightly colored beanbags and marketing agencies to come up with great ideas. They want invention, which is brilliant science and amazing tech that has no particular usefulness or that they can't figure out any usefulness for. Or, and in the majority of cases, they just want bog standard improvement. They want the machine to run slightly better. Because really, at the end of the day, innovation is taking a sledgehammer to the machine. It's breaking things and it's risky. So talk to us about making sure your next big idea is really innovative or at least classified of improvement and being honest with yourself.
Yeah, so that's a great point. When I talk to companies all the time, they like to say innovation is a priority, but the actions don't really reflect that. And there are a lot of reasons for that. You know, like when it comes down to like the day-to-day business tasks, we need to get those done. And so innovation almost gets looked at as like this extracurricular type of thing. And that's, that's fine sometimes, but really like in order to sustain long-term success, you really need to treat it as more of a priority. So I'm 100% with you there. One of the things that, you know, I think about innovation is it gets a little buzzwordy. It's really hard to define. When we step back and we talk about let's go with the first I, like ideation and how to balance that. You're really looking at three areas. You're looking at problems that the company is having. You're looking at needs that a company is having. Or in general, if you're looking to start a new business, let's also say that, like everyday problems that people are facing or needs that people have and wants. And so if you're going to try and take this sledgehammer, as you said, which I love, by the way, it's a great analogy. It's really important to go to the company and say like, hey, you know, we've gone through this ideation process and we've identified these problems. Now, what that means is like, if you do not solve those problems, here are the potential consequences. And one of the things I also talk about in the book is, I call it like the stoplight of innovation. And so like people are going to become irrelevant. Companies are going to become irrelevant. Processes are going to become irrelevant. And whether, you know, how much time you wait can put you at risk for being out innovated. So if you're, you know, you wait 10 years, you're at a red light, you're probably out innovated. You're waiting 5 years, you're at a yellow light, you still are at the potential to be able to switch things up. But there's concern. And under that, there's I talk about the green light, which is like 2.5 years, and the turn signal. And the turn signal is important because it's like sometimes you just went through an innovation process, but there's now even a better way to do it. And it's important to take that sledgehammer. So I think it's really honing down like, this is the problem this innovation relates to. This is the need that the company has, or this is the want that the company wants to put forward, or that the customers have as well.
Yeah, it's really great. I think it's two things that come to my mind when you say this. One is that I want to say Hayden Christensen. I hope that's the right word. Maybe I get the name wrong, but you know, the whole innovator's dilemma talks a lot about the fact that, you know, it's actually quite normal that you're spending 5% of your profit on the next 30% of your profit, actually. And you do that through innovation, R&D, and all that stuff. It's just tricky to find which one you do. And then there's a really great talk by someone around over and Amazon who said, like, you know, of all the 100 ideas you do, the 1% is the one that actually creates the next profit.
Yeah.
The really tricky thing I found is when you say, you know, take it 5-10 years and then you're dead. Both me and Troy worked for big companies, and you just said earlier, you know, you look at how ideation or how innovation works in a big company, and they don't really seem shaken by that, you know. So my question is always, okay, let's take someone as big as a bank as HSBC or someone like that, you know, mm-hmm. or BT Telco or whatever. Mm-hmm. They don't seem to see that big shock coming and don't seem to take it necessarily seriously enough in order to enable innovation to grow. Mm-hmm. So are they really not going to be there in 5 or 10 years? Because the odd thing I see at the same time, and I don't know how that works with the innovation part, I'm really curious, is, you know, they seem to die very slowly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I see that.
Yeah, so there are a couple things I'm going to dive into there. So the first is, like, there's an element of kind of where the industry life cycle is. So, you know, something like typewriters, like, you know, if you there are still collectors out there that still are looking for typewriters. And, you know, if you make something that's really creative, they'll be out there. But that's an industry that's obviously in decline. Something that's with banks, that's a little bit more of a trickier one because it's not really in decline. People still need banks. There's an argument around cryptocurrency and all of that. But, you know, we're not at the point where I would say banking is in decline by any mean. And so when these large companies, especially people that have kind of just like not been in a situation where they've had to innovate, they just need to keep the process, like cut costs and maybe grow customers as well. What I would always say to them is look at, you know, like the potential of losing customers versus not being there, because what's going to end up happening is people are going to shift, or the potential to add new customers. So as we're talking about banking here, let's just dive into this. So Robinhood, which is a trading platform, came in and really disrupted the banking industry. Now, a lot of these banks had trading platforms, but, you know, they did not innovate. And as a result, they lost a lot of potential customers by not rethinking this process. And so will they completely disappear? Sometimes they won't, and especially with something as strong as banking and, you know, an industry that's often backed by governments, if something goes wrong as well, you know, that argument can be made. But there's definitely the potential to really lose out on a significant growth opportunity. And sometimes it things do happen, like Uber and ride sharing completely, you know, mess up the taxi industry. And so a lot of these taxi conglomerates, like, were not able to stay together. So it's not impossible, but you have to understand that as you're looking to grow the company and you want to gain profitability, or you want to, like, stop losing the potential for profitability, you really need to go into this innovation process.
And a favorite quote of mine is, we will always need banking. We won't always need banks.
Oh, I love that.
It really kind of sums up exactly what we're seeing in the transformation with some of these new kind of challenger banks that are coming in.
Yeah.
And even though I'm not a huge fan, the whole DeFi movement of decentralized finance, people still want banking services. They don't want the traditional banks. Governments still want banks because they're doing their bidding for them, especially when it comes to compliance, terrorism funding stopping, and anti-money laundering and all the rest. But let's go off in a slightly different direction. Startup founders are indeed a very unique breed. I've had a company, Marcus has had a company, you've had a company, and at some point we are delusional, well beyond where it is safe and comfortable to be delusional. And none of us likes to be told that we have a very ugly baby. None of us likes to be told that our idea sucks. But they latch onto Crazy Jack and say, yeah, but nobody thought 128 characters of microblogging was ever going to be a business either. And look how wrong they were.
Yeah.
And they have this survivor bias.
Mm-hmm.
How in the world do you help somebody who is genuinely a good person with huge amount of drive and grit and go understand that sometimes of the 900 ideas they've got, 899 suck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So whenever I'm in this situation, one of the things I always think about is the sunk cost fallacy, where now I've spent so much of my time in this idea, or I've spent so much of this time committed to it, that it feels like almost like it's a sunk cost and I should keep going because I've put so much time in that. But in economics, that's not always the best solution to move forward. You know, your time is valuable and a resource in itself. And so if we're moving forward on a product, and most of these founders, as they're delusional, part of it is like belief in the idea, but part of it is also belief in themselves. Like they believe they are part of a team, or they believe individually, depending on how they're starting the company, that they can lead. And so talking about the sunk cost fallacy, I think, is a good way to kind of put it in a high level perspective. Like, hey, you've been working on this and, you know, this is the progress you've had. Like, you have the great potential to go there. And, you know, pivot in a way that might be advantageous. I think that's a good high level way to put it. I think there's also a second kind of strategy you can use, is always talking about the, I ask a couple of different questions. I always say, do you have a clear market for the idea? Because sometimes people go off and they have not even thought about or really understand their market. And that's a very dangerous time waster. The second thing I talk about is whether you want the market, or whether, I'm sorry, the market wants the idea now. If I created something like a biochip, you know, that's like maybe a really innovative idea, but necessarily society isn't ready to put, you know, machinery in their body. Some people, there are always early adopters and early innovators, but most people are not really ready there. So that's probably not the right market timing. It's actually interesting. Bill Gross, the founder of Idea Lab, he created a survey of companies where he looked at funding, idea, team, business model, and timing, and found that timing accounted for 42% of success. So I really honed that in on the like really innovative entrepreneur. Make sure that your market's ready for the idea. And then the last is just the resources to make the idea happen. Do you have the expertise? Do you have the people in place? Can you get those people? Do you have the money? There are a lot of resources to make an idea successful, and you have to map out exactly what you need so you can understand. And so if there's a missing resource that you seem like it would be hard to obtain, that's another way to look at the high level and business and to kind of indicate to the founder like, hey, you know, maybe it's time for a pivot.
So if you look at that, if you look at pivoting and testing your idea, whatever, the thing that likely comes into play is reality. And you go, exactly that, right? Fit to market, fit to reality. Are we actually solving a problem? And I'm in the middle of one of those many projects where you go and try to help companies get a better check with reality through research and actually talking to customers, which is often a big woohoo moment for a lot of organizations. How do you usually, you know, what for you sort of the quickest, most de-risking way to go and test, check with reality? Because as you know, everyone's got ideas. What's sort of the quickest thing to do? Because, you know, a lot of startups, as you just explained, never quite do that, and then they fall flat or never quite get there. You want to have some check with it. What's your view on that one, please?
So one of the things I talk about when I'm in this process is I talk about what I call the minimum viable idea. So as a startup, there's so much that goes into creating a successful company. So what I always tell people as we're trying to evaluate the business as a whole is take a step back and look at just the problem and what is the minimum idea your startup needs to solve that problem. What you may have a lot of elements, a lot of features, especially in tech startups. What is the minimum? This is the least thing that I could create that would solve that problem. And then look and evaluate that. You know, the other features may be great and may be like long-term growth opportunities, but when we're starting a company, we really need to hone in on who's facing the problem, what is that problem, what is the minimum amount of, you know, basically work that I need to put in, commitment I need to make to test to make sure that this is viable. And so a lot of times we'll take that scaled back approach, this almost like skeleton approach of that minimum viable idea, and really look, What is the minimum there? And that's sometimes a really good way to get a good perspective and grounding in where your company is.
One of my favorite quotes from a fairly successful entrepreneur was, the best entrepreneurs pivot around problems instead of pivoting around products. And you really have to have a deep understanding of the problem that you're solving. The second part of that is, will someone pay to have that problem solved? And that's something I have seen, and I've actually done it myself in one of my earliest startups, is I was solving a problem for consumers that they wouldn't pay to have solved. Yeah. And there was nobody else in the value chain that was going to pay. And there was the value exchange just simply wasn't there. Mm-hmm. So how do you help people understand? And one more thing before I unleash you on this particular question.
Yeah, no.
I always say that value is defined as one or more of five things. How do you make money, save time, add joy, or remove pain? And if you're not describing your product in one or more of those five ways, you don't have a value proposition. So with that as an opener, what's the deal with people who are not connecting value to their product?
Yeah. You know, this is everything you just said there is so great. I'm just like cheering along as a listener. You know, I love that. I think one of the things, and one of the founders of Red Antler, which is a branding company, talks about this when you're creating a brand, but I think it applies really well to entrepreneurship as well. It's almost like the fear of death principle. So how it works is, like, when you're asking like about your problems or thinking about your problems, you're like, why do I want this problem solved? And like, why is that important to me? You keep asking questions. Let's talk about something like, even like a telephone, you know, like, I want to connect to people. Why do you want to connect to people? You know, like, I want to stay in touch. And what does it mean? And it's like, everything can come back to, well, before I die, I want to feel like I'm fulfilled and that I, you know, I'm having this like connection, you know, thing. And if you can't really work back to something that's like, you know, like, obviously that's a very extreme, but that's kind of the idea. You really want to root your problems back to something where it's like, this problem is related to something that's so deep in this person's kind of like conscious. You know, saving time, that's big. You know, we all want to live efficient. Adding joy, that's another one that you talked about that's really big. And it comes back to like, this problem is something that really can make me feel more fulfilled, make my life better. And so when we talk about those value propositions, if you're solving a problem that doesn't really work back to something that's like a core, you know, element of the customer or like human experience, then you're just not going to have as good a chance to find success. You'll end up being more of kind of a luxury item and it may not even take off. And so I really think the products and the companies that come down to that core feeling, that almost fear of death feeling, is where you'll find the most success.
So you spun really nicely into one of my other questions. I'm going to jump the sequence. I'm going to push Marcus back and I'm going to ask my next question.
Oh, nice.
hopefully he won't be too angry at me. emotion trumps logic every time. And there are so many products, so many companies that should never have seen the light of day, and yet they do. And there are so many other companies that have succeeded, you know, failed horribly, but were beautifully solving a problem. And I put some of that down to the emotional connection of not just the product, but the way it's communicated. And as a corollary to that, and all listeners know exactly how I feel about this, Bitcoiners are a cult promoting a product with no value, you know, trying to do a Ponzi scheme as a marketing playbook. But it's all charged emotion. Bitcoin should never have gone anywhere, and yet it did. What's the secret sauce? How do you navigate that? I mean, you were kind of talking about, you know, going back to the point of dying, and maybe that's the short answer, but any further thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think as we take a step back, there needs to be, for a successful idea, you do need both the logic there and the emotional connection. I would say that there's kind of this fine balance, and a lot of times we get too focused on just the idea itself, and that's kind of where you see ideas not matching. I think part of the creation is connecting to that emotional experience, that, like, you know, fear of dying, you know, what it means to, you know, like, have something, you know, be a part of your life. Cause that's ultimately what you're doing as a consumer. When you're investing in things, they, you know, they're becoming a part of your life. I buy food because I need to eat, or, you know, I buy books cause I want to bring knowledge into my life. So it's really coming down to identifying who that customer is and how they're feeling, that emotional trigger that's happening there, and then moving beyond there. And I think the fear of dying is like a good example, but it's really, you have to also build into that emotion, because the reality of it is there are lots of problems, and truthfully, there are a lot of solutions to these problems. You know, like if I want to get from one side of Washington, D.C. to the other, I could walk. I could take a bus, I could take the metro, I could take an Uber. Like, there are really any problem you face, and that's a high level example, but any problem you face, there are so many different solutions. So a really good solution that connects to an emotional experience is something that would be you know, more successful.
Great. Well, you've written a really interesting book. It's kind of a recipe of steps for people to follow in order to kind of navigate through the whole discovery process, identifying problems and needs and wants and doing the market validation. There's a lot of people that just don't want to put in the effort to actually go through all of that. There's another group of people that are afraid they're going to get to the end of that and have a big pile of nothing. How do you deal with the inherent fear? I don't want to test my own idea for fear that it's not good enough. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm going to take this back almost to the minimum viable idea. And I use this kind of philosophy the same way with, you know, individuals who are a little bit scared of taking the risk. I would say, what's the minimum amount you're willing to try? What's the, like, you know, a little bit, are you willing to send out a survey and get some market research? Are you willing to do and kind of work that direction with the minimum viable amount each time to sort of get your feet wet, almost in a sense? I think there's also the element of people are a little bit frustrated with how we've sort of taught entrepreneurship. And it comes to a point where anytime we talk about these things, we're talking about like such big players that already have gone through the whole process, but people don't realize that there are so many failures along the way. And that's okay, because that's how you learn. And I think, you know, understanding that and understanding the little steps you can take is a really good way to just put your idea out there, see what happens. And I feel like a lot of people have the ability to try those little steps.
Okay. I think, unfortunately, we always have more questions than we have time. It's the same here. We could talk to you for hours. So as a last question to wrap up, what's your thought on big organizations who are already established and already there are very different, obviously, to startups who have to start from scratch, figure a lot of things out. And in big organizations, when innovation happens, you always have people expecting return of, you know, like money to be made within the first 3, 4, 6, 9 months, which is insane because that's rarely how companies grow. What's your view on there for innovation in companies and the expectations that they should maybe put in place so that ideas have a chance to survive and grow long enough to prove themselves?
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. I think part of it is we're very used to this like Silicon Valley investor style of entrepreneurship. And when you put that much money into a company, you almost give it like steroids, like you give it a boost. And not all companies really have access to that. And that's not necessarily realistic for everyone. And it's the right path for some companies, just not all of them. And so I think part of it is like understanding, instead of the money, you can take a look at how many customers you can get on board, how many people want to be a part of your journey and move that way. You know, like if you start a company and by the end of year one, you have, you know, let's say it's a business to business, like you have three companies on board that are really invested in your product. Yeah, that's a big success. You have like your, you know, your first sales and can start getting testimonials built from there. So I think looking at it like break even doesn't always necessarily make sense depending on the situation. It makes sense when you're talking about investments because people want their money back on their investment. But as an entrepreneur, you're looking to build a company, not necessarily, you know, get the return on investment as fast as possible. You want the longest, like long-term growth in the best way. And so I think thinking about it from a customer perspective and looking at how many people you're bringing on board to this problem that you're solving, I think that's a really good way to look at it instead. And, you know, each individual company can create individual goals around that depending on the type of business they are.
Well, Sam, thank you so much for helping us kind of break it all down as to coming up with our next big idea. Really appreciate your time and your insights and wish you a great rest of your day. Thanks for being on our show.
I had so much fun having this conversation. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Wicked Podcast with co-host Marcus Kirst and me, Troy Norcross.
Please subscribe on Podomatic, iTunes, or Spotify. You can find all relevant links in the show notes. Please tell us your thoughts in the comment section and let us know about any books for future episodes.
You can also get in touch with us directly on Twitter on @WickedAndBeyond or @Troy_Norcross. Also, learn more about the Wicked Company book and the Wicked Company project at wickedcompany.com.